once again, and welcome back to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. My name is Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. Well, today's lecture, Target Organ Toxicology, what we're going to try to do is explore an array of targets for specific and general types of toxicosis. Many of us, and just in terms of our previous exposure to the media representations and perhaps in biology classes, have heard some of the terminology that we'll talk about in today's lecture. For example, one of those terms is neurotoxicity or neurotoxic agents. We have a history in terms of the military history across the globe of the potential or actual use of neurotoxic agents in chemical warfare. These highly potent chemicals used in anger, used in hate to achieve a particular military or social objective, unfortunately. We've also heard about, for example, neurotoxic agents in our discussions about pesticides. A broad category of pesticides, of insecticides, the organophosphorus insecticides and the N-methylcarbamates, are neurotoxic agents. They function in a way to inhibit the transport of various neurochemicals. What we're going to try to do today is talk about toxicology from the point of view of target organs that may be impacted by these chemical compounds. Our learning objectives here today, what I'd like you to do is be able to define target organ toxicity in a broad way. We'll try to as well have you explain the basis for the specificity of organ toxicity. Some of the dominant factors in human physiology that will enable or accelerate specific organ toxicity, and one of these, for example, is blood flow to that specific organ. If in fact we have a blood-borne toxicant from a route of primary absorption, those organs that are getting higher concentrations because of the higher blood flow of that organ have the potential for enhanced target toxicity. We'll try to contrast some of the different toxicity mechanisms for a range of target organ toxicities, including hemotoxicity associated with blood, hepatotoxicity associated with your liver, nephrotoxicity associated with kidneys, and then dermotoxicity, skin irritation. Many of those of us have experienced that if we have a particular chemical sensitivity, and also pulmonary toxicity associated with respiratory toxicosis. Now, in terms of further learning objectives, we will try as well to describe some of the examples of target organ toxicity, and we'll do this through case studies and specific slides, for example, of cellular destruction associated with specific tissues. We'll try to discuss some of the clinical characteristic evaluative procedures that in a clinical setting we use to determine toxicity in various target organs. I'd like you also to be able to explain the concept of oxidative stress. We're going to try to have you demonstrate that you understand the action of antioxidant enzymes and redox cycling compounds. Oxidative stress isn't necessarily classified as a target organ toxicity, but it is a broadly based toxic manifestation that is associated with many sorts of clinical endpoints. This is as good a place as any to discuss that particular presentation of toxicosis. We'll try to also explore neurotoxicity because of its importance in neurological development, its importance in terms of potential interactions and the disabling potential of this particular route of toxicosis. So I'd like you to be able to examine the molecular pathways of cholinesterase inhibition in a discussion of neurotoxicity. Now, in terms of target organ toxicity, we can best describe that in a generic way as the adverse effects or disease states that are manifested in specific organs of the body associated with toxicosis. We find that high cardiac output to a particular organ or organelle will yield the potential for higher exposure and therefore the potential for a larger amount of toxic end effect. The organs that we'll talk about each have specialized tissues and specialized cells. Because of this, they have specific receptors that might be reactive, transport phenomena, specific actions or reactions that are required. And our target organ toxicants actually can have selective toxicity towards those modes of physiology and biochemistry that are important for that particular organ or organelle. We'll find that we have on these various organ types differentiated cellular processes and receptors, and these will key into the specific potential chemical reactivity that we might have in a target organ toxicity. We find that various toxicants and their metabolites may have specific reactive pathways. In other words, a primary per-parent toxic compound may have a different target organ effect than its metabolite due to the structural chemical change associated with biotransformation. And one of the things we need to understand is that toxicants do not necessarily affect all organs to the same extent. It may have several different sites of action and several target organs. And so we may refer to something as a nephrotoxin, but at the same time, that toxicant may have a general toxicosis or general reactivity to multiple organs. We also have to be very mindful that multi-toxicant exposure may target the same organ. And so this is essentially a buildup of potential end effects through multiple exposures of different compounds. We can find, for example, in endocrine disruption that there's additive effects. Different chemicals, wildly different perhaps even in their chemical function and structure, may have the same sort of receptor endpoints in terms of endocrine disruption. We find also in an examination of target organ toxicity that the target organ may not be the site for storage. And so we might have storage and systemic distribution of a toxicant, but the site of action, the site of toxicity may be, for example, hepatotoxicity, toxicity of the liver. Various toxicokinetic processes will help determine the concentrations that present at different organs. The toxicokinetic processes coupled with recirculation or circulation, as well as exposure via blood flow and high blood flow to specific organs, will enable target organ toxicity. One of the ways to examine blood flow is to look at the resting cardiac output. This particular graphic is for a 63 kilogram male. On the y-axis, we have 0 to 100% of the whole body cardiac output. And these bar graphs represent essentially a generic or average sort of blood flow in a resting adult male. What we see is this 27.8. This is the highest level of cardiac output to a specific organ. This particular organ is the liver. In past presentations, we've alluded to the fact that the high blood flow first pass effects is important because the liver bioprocesses many of our nutrients, these products of initial digestion that are required in terms of energy, in terms of biosynthesis of more complex molecules for the development of the organism. The kidney at 23% also has significant blood flow, the brain at 14%. And so you can see these three organs have specific cardiac outputs that enable them to not only receive and process nutrients, but also to consume, in the case of the brain, and for example, blood sugar and oxygen, to consume those reactants in terms of normal physiological function. Interestingly enough, in terms of how this changes an adult in exercise, this skeletal muscle cardiac output here at rest, about 16%, can jump to as high as 60% of blood flow in terms of very vigorous athletic activity. Another way to look at this is not from cardiac output, from the actual resting blood flow in milliliters per minute. When we look at this in terms of the whole body blood flow, we get about 5.4 liters per minute. So the maximum blood flow for the whole body. And again, on a flow basis, what we find is that about 1,500 milliliters per minute, 1.5 liters per minute passes through your liver. This is a substantial amount of your overall blood capacity on a very rapid basis. And so the blood flow going to these specific organs parallels the cardiac output on a quantitative basis. Kidney at 1,260 milliliters per minute, the brain at 750 milliliters per minute. And so these determine if, in fact, we've got circulating toxicants, which organs will be presented with those particular toxicants. Obviously, we have blood flow to all of our organs at some level or another, but more rapid, more quantitative flow has the potential on a quantitative mass development basis to present that, but also respect that the liver as the primary organ for biotransformation in terms of the survival of species has the ability to detoxify toxicants. And so from a survival evolutionary point of view, we probably are best served by having our blood flow go to our liver. We need also to kind of understand some of the major blood circulation pathways in terms of how blood is presented to the various organs, the lungs, the liver, the kidneys, and the gastrointestinal tract, and also to aid in not only absorption but elimination of metabolic byproducts. This cartoon, again, this is not a physiology class, but from an introductory perspective, should give you a roadmap of how blood circulates. What we're primarily concerned in terms of first pass effects is the vascularization and transport of digested nutrients from the gastrointestinal tract up into the liver via the portal vein. This is a primary process. This plus the pulmonary blood flow allows the liver to have this maximal sort of blood flow in terms of its position of dominance in terms of the circulation of blood in the human body. Well, let's start off in a discussion of all of our target organ toxicities, and our first is hemotoxicity, and this has to do with toxicity affecting blood cell components. The blood cell components include the erythrocytes, or the red blood cells, the leukocytes, these white blood cells that have several different functions, including immune functions, and the thrombocytes, another major category of blood cells, and these are important in terms of clotting function. We find that hemotoxicity occurs when the number or the function of these blood cells is impaired by a toxicosis. So the number, the function of cells can get changed or damaged when we have exposure to various toxicants. For example, we've talked about the ability of nitrate and nitrite to actually oxidize ferric iron in hemoglobin, important for oxygen transport, to oxidize ferrous iron to ferric iron and inhibit oxygen transport. We also have the ability of cyanide and other gases or other inorganic substrates like carbon monoxide or sulfide to actually inhibit the ability of iron to either transport oxygen or to carry it off in terms of the ability of normal physiological functioning. We also can damage the blood system by changing the number of the particular blood cells. A loss of red blood cells or a decrease in the amount of blood cells associated with toxicosis can yield anemia. An increase in white blood cells via toxicosis can yield leukemia. We can also have a decrease in thrombocytes or granulocytes, agranulocytopenia or thrombocytopenia. This is a decrease in thrombocytes or granulocytes, again, components of the blood cell components. in terms of evaluation, how do we evaluate a patient for hemotoxicity? We do this primarily through complete blood counts. We have normal ranges for all of the blood components. Last time you did a physical, you may have had a CBC workup on your chart. There will be a count and a range in terms of a normal range. Your physician will tell you if you have a number out of that range, and perhaps that's due to, for instance, having an infectious process where your white blood cell count might be elevated, or perhaps you might have familial anemia due to some sort of genetic defect. You can also determine hemotoxicity by a number of physical analyses, such as arterial blood gases. Arterial blood gas will tell the clinician whether or not your oxygen transport is up to par. And we can also directly take a look at either the toxicants or the metabolites, typically in plasma, as a blood carrier. This is a short discussion of a case study, and this is methemoglobinemia, which is the oxidation from nitrite of ferrous iron to ferric iron in hemoglobin. This is an interesting case. This was in 2002 in Mortality Morbidity Weekly Report for the CDC. This was in Yonkers, New York, and what happened was a household of Middle Eastern adults in Yonkers, and three men aged 40, 43, and 44, and two women 60 and 29. They reported symptoms of dizziness, lightheadedness, and they were cyanotic in terms of starting to turn blue because of oxygen transport problems. After sharing a meal, when they presented, they were vomiting. Someone who was also in the household who did not eat the meal was asymptomatic. They found the younger woman unresponsive. The others were awake and alert. There was progressive respiratory distress in this one young woman, loss of consciousness. She was intubated, which aids in respiratory relief. There were seizures in the older woman. At the emergency department, they were cyanotic. They had oxygen saturation levels that were 72 to 96%. Normal was greater than 92%. The blood that was drawn from them was described as black colored. There was an empiric therapy delivered. The clinicians, the emergency treatment, suspected poisoning after consultation with a poisoning control center. The therapy for methemoglobinemia is a injection of methylene blue. Methylene blue, the same chemical that you use as a dye in some freshman chemistry experiments. Subsequently, the follow-up analysis, and this methylene blue acts as a reducing agent to help reverse the nitrate toxicosis. What happened in terms of follow-up clinical analysis is that they had extremely high methemoglobin levels. Again, this is the hemoglobin with ferric iron, 21 to 87% methemoglobin. The normal is 1 to 3% in this particular case. After about 10 or 15 minutes of administration of the antidote, the methylene blue, the cyanosis resolved and oxygenation improved. So this is a rapid acting antidote. Three men became asymptomatic after therapy, and the two women, which had more advanced health problems associated with this exposure, actually required ventilation, intubation, and respiratory support. And it pretty much took them a couple of days to resolve this. In terms of the follow-up disease investigation, they found that someone had been using sodium nitrite, which is a curing reagent used in meat preparation, and it was put into a bag that had been marked iodized table salt, mislabeling episode causing a significant toxicosis and a potential lethality in this case to several people. Well, our next target organ toxicity is a hepatotoxicity. Our liver, as we've said several times in here, is a very functionally important organ for life processes, these primarily being biosynthesis and nutrient metabolism. It's the most important organ that we have in terms of toxicology for detoxification and biotransformation. This is where a lot of it happens. It's the primary site for metabolism, and we use isolated hepatocytes to study chemical biotransformation in terms of a study of metabolism of various toxicants. We have in the liver a high cardiac output, and therefore we have these first pass effects from the portal vein. It's important as well to consider the fact that there is a recirculation. This organ is so important in biosynthesis that we want to ensure via enterohepatic recirculation that any nutrients that are available via the diet, via normal sorts of life-sustaining requirements, are actually presented and reused and used in high efficiency. And that's probably the evolutionary strategy of enterohepatic recirculation. But we also note that primary toxicants and metabolites can be also recirculated. This slide gives you a macro analysis. This is a cross section of the diseased liver. This actually is a bovine liver. Typical of what you see if you've ever seen liver in the market or in the butcher shop, you notice that it is typically uniform, kind of muddy red in color. This diseased liver is anything but. It shows signs of infarction or decreased blood flow, and so you see a light pinking of the tissue here in the center part from decreased blood flow. You can even see some white tissue. You can see necrosis where, in fact, cells have broken down and there's clots forming, and you can see hemorrhage in terms of the potential aspect of leakage of some of the blood vessels within this relatively uniform tissue that has a tremendous amount of blood flow passing through it. If we take a look at a microscopic representation, a histological representation of liver tissue, liver is made up of these repeating segments of lobules. Each lobule is in fact a little biofactory. It has blood transport, it has connections to the portal vein, it has a hepatic artery in terms of passage of blood into the tissue and then out of the tissue. And as well, we also have a third transport, and these are bile ducts. And bile is actually made by the liver hepatocytes and transported via the bile duct to the bile, to the gallbladder, and to the bile duct for transport back into the gastrointestinal tract. These hepatocytes are arranged in these lobules. Each one has the ability to do all of the metabolism that we have talked about in terms of phase one and phase two biotransformations. Now, in terms of hepatotoxicity, if we look at the liver not for what it can do in a positive way, but perhaps how we can damage it through toxicity, there are primary modes of toxicity. We can have cytotoxic effects, things like lipid peroxidation, and this is an oxidative stress reaction from a reactive, typically free radical process. When we have lipid peroxidation, we can have the impact of breaking the cell membrane. When we break the cell membrane, we destroy the potential of that cell to have its normal physiological processes, and we have leakage of cellular components, sometimes very bioactive, into the general organ. We can have direct necrosis, tissue death, cellular death. Sometimes this can be localized, sometimes this can be fairly substantial in terms of the range and toxicity of the particular exposure. We can have cirrhosis, scarring, a buildup of scarring tissue if we have repeated necrosis, development of fibrosis. These sorts of fibroid materials are not tissues that function like normal liver tissue, and sometimes they can actually block flow. They can be cholestatic, blocking the flow of the bile in terms of buildup of these non-vascularized tissues, these scar tissues. In certain conditions, such as alcohol, we can also develop fatty liver, again, interrupting normal biological function of this most important of organs. The cholestatic aspects, these can be interrupted flow of bile. This can be from tissue damage and scarring. It can also be the development of stones, gallstones, and various calcium-based deposits that actually physically obstruct the various bile pathways within the liver and in the bile duct. There are several liver function indicators. In your last physical, in your blood analysis, you probably looked, had your physician probably looked or surveyed for several liver enzymes. Liver enzymes belong in the liver, not in the general blood supply. There's a normal range. If you exceed that normal range, typically that's an indicator of hepatotoxicity at some degree or another. What that means is the cells of your liver are being damaged. The enzymes that are within your hepatocytes are being released into general blood flow. And this is diagnostic of some sort of liver problem. There can also be gross tissue effects. The liver is one organ. We can actually do a needle biopsy. Not a comfortable, very invasive procedure, but this is where a needle is actually inserted into your abdomen. Not particularly comfortable assay, I'm sure. And this particular needle, a fairly fat one, has the ability to sample a bit of your lung, your liver tissue, and pull it out for microscopic examination. This is where they would examine for fibrous tissues, cirrhosis or fatty tissues, cellular damage to give you kind of a diagnostic of hepatotoxicity. Now, the liver is a regenerable organ. As getting the primary toxic burden from our diets in terms of our exposure, you would have to imagine that as a frontline defense, there's a certain amount of inherent danger and inherent toxicosis to the cells in the liver. So the liver has a remarkable regenerating ability, the most regenerable organ in your body, because of this onslaught of normal, natural, exogenous compounds that come to us through our diet, through environmental exposures, through occupational exposures. We're going to do a quick focus area here because several times during the course I've referred to oxidative stress and also the importance of antioxidants in your diet. What we'll do here in this small sidebar segment is talk about this important area and perhaps with the bottom line result of remembering what your mom told you about eating your fruits and vegetables as important sources of antioxidants in your diet. What we find is that all aerobes, air breathers like you and me, we breathe air, and in our respiratory processes, we actually generate free radicals. So this is a normal part of our function, our respiratory function. In a certain sense, what is combustion other than the combining of carbon materials with oxygen? And in a certain sense, our physiology is a controlled combustion. As a respiratory byproduct, we create superoxide, which is an oxygen-free radical. We'll see that normal oxidant or antioxidant enzyme system actually detoxifies these free radicals. And interesting to note that our antioxidant enzymes are inducible. They're inducible via, for example, training and exercise. A marathon runner will have a higher level of respiratory function than perhaps many of us. This individual will need to process more oxygen. In physiology terms, this individual will have a high VO2 max or volume of oxygen that they can consume and process because of their training and because of their genetics and their physiology. These inducible antioxidant enzymes include catalase, an iron-based enzyme, superoxide dismutase, SOD, often a zinc or manganese-based enzyme, and glutathione peroxidase, which is a selenium-based enzyme system. All of these important parts of this antioxidant, this inducible antioxidant enzyme system that allows for proper respiratory physiology. What we find, though, is that we can be exposed to a class of compounds referred to as redox cycling compounds. And when I say redox cycling, think of the Energizer Bunny commercial and a rechargeable battery, a battery that can take on a charge but also discharge. And in fact, these redox cycling compounds are those sorts of compounds. They can be readily oxidized and subsequently reduced by normal biochemical processes. This can lead to radical formation. It's a rechargeable cycle, and so redox cycling compounds are typically not good compounds to be exposed to. Some of the toxic endpoints of greatest concern with redox cycling compounds and oxidative stress are things like radical formation leading to lipid peroxidation. And because we have very reactive chemicals running around in oxidative stress cycling, we can have, for example, DNA strand breaks, among other toxic endpoints. Typically, these redox cycling compounds are highly polar. They have in their nature the ability to be oxidized by oxygen, O2. They also have the ability to be reduced by the flavin enzyme, FAD. For example, a couple of chemicals in that category are paraquat, a bipyridyl herbicide that's actively used, for example, in cotton production. Nitroaromatics of various kinds, chelated metals, zinc, for example, is one of them. These can actually act as redox cycling compounds. Some examples of the reactive oxygen species and the reactive nitrogen species that are produced by redox cycling compounds, the secondary effects, include superoxide in terms of the ROSs, the reactive oxygen species. We can find production of hydroxyl radicals, very, very reactive, high oxidative potential reactive products. We can also generate peroxyl or alkoxyl free radicals. In terms of reactive nitrogen species, these are typically the oxides of nitrogen. Nitrous oxide, nitric oxides are the two most prevalent. For those of you that have studied any immunology, know that in fact our physiology, we will use nitric oxides as a part of immune function and phagocytosis in terms of battling various infectious agents. So where do these radical species that we're exposed to come from? Primarily exposure is through breathing of oxygen, again, because we are controlled internal combustion. In our respiratory physiology, we have the ability to adapt and control this. But we also can be exposed to free radicals from UV radiation, from various infectious processes, from various oxidants and redox cycling compounds that can be found in our food or in environmental exposure. Free radicals, if you remember from freshman chemistry and perhaps your organic chemistry, they're highly reactive. They can initiate chain reactions, and this chain reaction has a lot to do with finding electron-rich molecules. And so these are electrophilic reactions because a free radical has an unpaired electron. This is a high-energy state. It is seeking to find lower energy states, so it is highly reactive. This reactivity can lead to damage of cells, and not only in cells, but some of the biomolecules, including the molecules of life and DNA. Damaged DNA is obviously not good DNA in terms of its potential for carcinogenesis, its potential for mutagenesis. There is some aspect of free radicals that is a factor in degenerative disease. Some folks have characterized aging process as us essentially succumbing to free radical and oxidative exposure throughout our entire life. That's why there have been tremendous number of diet and nutrition studies associated with consuming antioxidants in terms of a diet rich in fruits and vegetables and naturally occurring chemicals in those plants, and as well as antioxidants that are consumed in terms of vitamin supplements. Some of these antioxidants can perform the function of free radical scavengers. Vitamin C and beta carotene will directly quench reactive oxygen. Vitamin E and beta carotene can break these free radical chain reactions. Selenium in selenium glutathione peroxidase will quench peroxides, and we'll see how that works. There are some beneficial oxidative processes. I don't want you to go away thinking that oxidation is a bad thing. In fact, it's required for necessary life processes. We use it for chemotaxis, or the chemical communication of cells with immunological functions. The process of phagocytosis actually uses it to kill off infectious organisms. Oxidative processes are also involved in triggering of various clotting mechanisms and for the programmed cell death referred to as apoptosis. In terms of the mechanism of action of antioxidants, we find they decrease these reactive oxygen substances and reactive nitrogen substances from forming. We find that they can bind various redox cycling metal ions. They can scavenge the precursors and the actual oxidizing and reactive oxygen and reactive nitrogen species. It can actually also help form these adaptive antioxidant enzymes that we use in the response, the antioxidant response to the potential for these response to oxidating species. What we find is that some of these antioxidants assist in the repair of oxidative damage to various biomolecules. And it also can have a secondary effect of just enhancing the repair enzymes that are necessary to clean up the damage of oxidation. Now, this complex graphic is going to require a little bit of study. Hopefully online you can blow this up in the slides to see this. This pathway is the complete representation, or a complete representation, of oxidative stress. I talked about this battery, the redox cycle here, where we have a parent compound and a radical metabolite, for example, but it's cycling through here. It's actually releasing an electron on the oxidation side, and it's gaining an electron on the reduction side over here with FAD and the flavin enzyme. In a direct reactivity, some of these redox cycling compounds can create a free radical metabolite that can have direct covalent binding to nucleic acids or covalent binding to various proteins and potentially enzyme inactivation. What we can also find is that through this normal redox cycling process, we do create superoxide, or the oxygen-free radical. We do have a system, an antioxidant enzyme system, to manage superoxide. It starts off with superoxide dismutase, which actually strips off that oxygen. It does, however, create peroxide as a byproduct. Peroxide is still a relatively strong oxidant, very toxic on a cellular basis. We also have the ability up here to have catalase act directly on superoxide. Catalase can actually, or iron can actually have a hydroxyl-free radical as an end product. This free radical can have toxic endpoints of DNA strand breaks, lipid peroxidation, and enzyme inactivation. Peroxide can be acted on by catalase and glutathione peroxidase to actually reduce that down to water as a byproduct. And so this is our antioxidant enzyme cycle. It's two steps typically: superoxide dismutase to take superoxide and turn it into peroxide. Peroxide is then acted on by glutathione peroxidase or catalase to produce water. Stepwise deactivation of these very reactive oxidants. As I said, some of the endpoints of oxidative stress that we need to be concerned about: lipid peroxidation, DNA strand breaks, enzyme inactivation, various covalent binding of molecules to nucleic acids, and potential problem associated with these DNA adducts, as well covalent binding to various proteins that have necessary physical, biophysical activity. In terms of this enzymatic response and this inducible enzymatic response, when you think about it, think about a bird that is flying in migration hundreds if not thousands of miles, and how its physiology needs to be able to respond to a high energy output and bioprocessing of respiratory physiology and oxygen, and the ability to essentially put the fire out that's initiated by respiratory processes. these animals have to have very good antioxidant enzymatic response to free radical formation. So we have these SODs, in this case magnesium superoxide, manganese superoxide dismutase, the production of a peroxide and selenium glutathione peroxidase. This is the reason why selenium is a required trace element in the human diet, is primarily through the production of selenium glutathione peroxidase, as well as some other selenol proteins. Our next examination in terms of target organ toxicity will be nephrotoxicity. Remembering from our previous discussions in terms of biotransformation and elimination that there are three major processes of the kidney, and they include the physical filtration, glomerular filtration. We then follow up in the proximal tubules with tubular reabsorption, and then we finally have tubular secretion, where we have this balancing of fluids such that the kidney filtrate is 99% reabsorbed back into the body. Now, obviously, with this orchestration of processes, we have potential for toxic effects at each one of those levels of process. We can damage the porosity of the glomerulus in terms of its filtration ability. When we damage those pores, they start out at 40 angstroms. If they get larger, what happens is larger molecules can pass through into a place they shouldn't be passing through, because larger molecules will not cross membranes in terms of reabsorption and secretion processes. It will change osmotic pressures in terms of dissolved solutes that might be in there. We can actually start having a substantial amount of macromolecules, proteinuria, protein appearing in your urine, hemoglobin appearing in your urine from various toxic damages. We can have modification of tubular reabsorption, and so we will end up with a water imbalance, electrolyte or nutrient loss, because that will not be reabsorbed. And we can lose active transport of nutrients and ions such as potassium across these membranes. Now, in terms of normal kidney histology, if you remember in our representations, this two-dimensional representations, you can see various glomerulus representation cross sections, these filtration. But these proximal tubules, they look like they should in terms of being essentially fire hoses on a microscopic basis. There's a lining and a area inside, so we have a representation of these tubules as that, a tube. When we cut them and they happen to be kind of laying on their side, for example, loop of Henle, we might see them represented as a longish section like this, as if we were cutting that cucumber lengthwise instead of crosswise. And so you get a sense that there is a tremendous amount of convoluted tubules associated with kidney microphysiology. In nephrotoxicity, we have several different syndromes. These are diagnostic of kidney damage. We can have nephrotic syndrome, and this is a glomerular filtration injury. Typically, a toxicant will act in a necrotic fashion to the glomerulus, and typically what this will lead to is the ability for larger molecules to cross into the kidney filtrate. Lead toxicosis, for example, will have this particular action, yielding protein in the urine because of nephrotic syndrome. We also have nephritic syndrome. This also is a glomerular filtration injury. This is diagnostic. There's very close similarity between these two syndromes. In this particular case, we find hemoglobin actually can pass into the kidney filtrate. We can also damage the various tubes that are a part of the nephron. We have a condition called ATN, or acute tubular necrosis. This yields acute renal failure, because if the glomerulus is filtering out this very high amount of filtrate, 99%, but yet it isn't being returned through the tubular reabsorption, what happens is you end up with a fluid imbalance. This acute renal failure can be not only acutely toxic, but potentially lethal in a fairly short amount of time because of the buildup of metabolic byproducts. We can also have obstructive tubular reabsorption effects in terms of transport and damage to all of these membranes, and obstructive uropathies where we actually have calcifications, kidney stones. Hopefully none of you ever have to go through that. I never have, but knowing people who have, this is not a fun event to have. These particular calcifications are physical disruptions of fluid flow, typically more painful than they are damaging in terms of overall fluid flow, because they occur in one part of the kidney and there is compensation either by your other kidney or other parts of your kidney. In terms of one of our neuropathies, toxic acute tubular necrosis is illustrated in this particular histograph. If you remember, we've got the glomerulus. This is a normal looking glomerulus, but the proximal tubules have epithelial necrosis and an obliterated lumen, or the outside tubing or piping. What was represented in the first histogram, you saw these as pipes. You now see no evacuated space in the center. These aren't functioning as pipes. In a certain sense, these are clogged pipes. This is not a good thing in terms of fluid flow in a nephron. Kidney function indicators, we can do in a clinical diagnostic series some analyses for kidney function to see if in fact you have a kidney toxicity. One of the ways to do this is to examine glomerular filtration rate, and we can do that by looking at various aspects of filtration of known and administered chemicals and biochemicals. One of these is paraaminohippuric acid, or PAH. PAH is cleared in terms of renal clearance by the and secreted from the filtrate completely back into the blood. When we find PAH in the urine, we know we are not getting tubular secretion back into it. If an individual is dosed with a higher level of PAH, this is a good assay to see, in fact, if that PAH is cleared or not. We can also look at removal of serum waste products that is a part of normal kidney function. BUN is blood urea nitrogen. That might show up in your annual physical blood analysis or urine analysis, excuse me. And this is an indicator of catabolism of protein. We want blood urea nitrogen levels in the blood to be low, but we want those to be discharged into the urine stream. We also can examine creatinine in terms of in the urinary stream. Creatinine is a muscle metabolism byproduct. We can also examine pulmonotoxicity as a target organ toxicity. Pulmonotoxicity quite often can occur very rapidly because of the rapid exchanges of gas that we have. Gas exchange is critical to life, and so we have to breathe, and we have minutes in terms of potential toxicity here if it's a dramatic impact in terms of gas exchange. Our lungs function to have rapid exchange. They're very high surface area. They're very sensitive in terms of mucosal tissues, and especially to toxicants that impact these highly water-based mucous membranes. There are, because of the surface area, because of the moisture, and because of the rapid potential intake of toxins through respiration, they are quite susceptible to damage. They can be damaged by chemical irritants, various carcinogens, allergens, mineral dusts, such as asbestos and silicon from mineral or soil dust, silicosis, and various cytotoxic chemicals. Some of the endpoints of pulmonotoxicity can include an inflammation response, edema meaning passage of fluids from your vascular system and your capillaries across the membranes and perhaps into your lung tissue. There can be tissue necrosis for acutely cytotoxic chemicals with repeated inflammation, repeated infection, repeated exposure to toxicants. We can develop fibrosis or carcinoma. Some of the disease manifestations of pulmonotoxicity is ARDS, or adult respiratory distress syndrome. This quite often is an infectious result of sepsis and hospitalization. It's highly lethal. Typically, it develops into an acute pneumonia, fluid filling, blood filling into your lungs. Not a desirable outcome in terms of hospitalization and disease management. We can have asthma, lung cancer. We can have infarcts, or essentially loss of blood flow to various parts of our lungs. We can also have emphysema, or the development of scar tissue from repeated exposure to toxicants, such as those presented, for example, by cigarette smoking. This slide gives you an idea. I've introduced the repeated exposure by these physical mineral toxicants such as asbestos. Asbestos is it's useful, or has been useful historically, because it is a fibrous mineral. Its physical characteristics allowed it to be used in many industrial applications. These industrial applications were useful for increasing the fire resistance of paints and insulation because of the potential of these fibers to be woven into various fabrics in terms of industrial uses. This is an asbestos fiber in lung tissue. On a microscopic basis, you can see that this needle, like mineral, has the ability to reside in tissue, to be a continuous irritant. It's this continuous physical irritation that yields the respiratory syndromes that start developing various forms of cancer associated with asbestos, typically asbestos in occupational exposure. Dermatotoxicity is another form of target organ toxicity. The skin being our largest organ, and therefore the potential for toxicosis is high. We are exposed to many potential toxicants in our normal daily life. Quite often it's with our hands because of the types and quantities of things that we touch. We can have a contact dermatitis. This isn't as much an allergy response as it is just a physical chemical response in terms of sometimes yielding a very uncomfortable skin reaction. We can have an allergic contact dermatitis, and we've introduced that allergies are the result of a sensitization to a chemical, typically a larger molecular weight chemical like a pollen protein. For those of you that have latex allergies, know that you're going to get a contact dermatitis and sometimes even leading to anaphylaxis if you use latex gloves, perhaps in a laboratory setting. Dermatotoxicity can also present as phototoxicity, where because we, especially in light-skinned individual, have the ability to have ultraviolet, low-energy ultraviolet and visible radiation from the sun have a photochemical effect with the chemicals, sometimes pharmaceuticals, sometimes natural products, that are circulating in our blood near our skin. In light-skinned people, it's blood is what gives light-skinned people a pink coloration. That blood can, those chemicals in the blood can have a reaction in the same way that vitamin D circulating in our blood has a reaction with sunlight, a positive one in terms of vitamin D synthesis. But sometimes this phototoxic reaction can actually enable a strong dermatotoxicity at the site of sun exposure. We can also have integumentary cellular effects. We've seen the demonstration, for example, of chloracne with chlorinated hydrocarbon exposure, such as dioxin exposure that we saw in some of the introductory lectures. The photo here is a phytophotodermatitis. phytophoto meaning that it's an interaction of a natural product, a phytochemical. In this particular case, it's oil of bergamot, which is found in citrus products, reacting with light on the skin, causing a significant dermatitis on this particular individual's hand. Neurotoxicity is going to be our final target organ toxicity that we'll talk about today. We've saved perhaps one of the more evolved and one of the more important target organ toxicities for last. Neurotoxicity impacts the neurological system. The neurological system is complex. It's made up of several components, including the CNS, or the central nervous system, the PNS, the peripheral nervous system. The central nervous system is the brain and spinal cord, as opposed to the peripheral nervous system, which is our sensory and motor control system. It's made up of neurons. The neurons have a cell body. They have dendrites reaching out to allow for interneuron communication. They also have axons to allow for transport of neurochemicals across synaptic gaps, introductory biology, if you will. We also find that the neurological system is made up of glial cells, which are presented for structure. Some of these are astrocytes that are important in various barriers, such as the blood-brain barrier, oligodendrites and Schwann cells, and the myelin coating associated with various neurons. There are microglia and various immune function glial cells as well, a fairly complex array of subsystems and systems in the neurosystem. This is an illustration representation of neurons. This is, again, high school biology level. And you can see that, in fact, the most important part that we're dealing with, obviously, in terms of neurotoxicity, anywhere in the cell can be directly impacted by a chemical to induce neurotoxicity. Quite often, we're dealing with chemicals that interrupt neurotransmission and neurotransmitter molecules across the synaptic cleft associated with communication from one neuron to another. In terms of the background processes happening in neurons, if we look at this in a generic way, we find that there's active transport of sodium out of the cells and potassium into the cells, and this does yield an electrical potential across these axonal membranes. We find that the next step is a passive reverse transport that initiates a cascading depolarization down the cell. This is the charging, if you will, of a neuron. At the synapses, we get a chemical conversion of this electrical energy into chemical energy as neurotransmitters are released, and they chemically transmit this depolarization to the next neuron. So this is a cascading or communicative effect. These neurotransmitters cross the synaptic cleft to the receptors at the next neuron. Neurotoxins, in terms of their target, can impact the sodium or potassium channels. And so we can see inhibition or stimulation both in terms of excitatory responses. We'll talk in terms of further analysis of some toxins such as poison fish toxins or fugu toxins, how some of these neurotoxins can impact our excitatory or hyperstimulated response, but other toxins can actually inhibit the same response. Neurotoxins can have an action in terms of binding neurotransmitter receptor sites. They can inhibit enzymes like cholinesterase that are responsible for various neurotransmitter catabolism. In a certain sense, neurotransmission needs to be a controlled transmission. We don't want to short circuit it. We want it to turn on when there's a pulse. We want it to turn off when there isn't a pulse. And so there's an orchestration of biochemistry at the synaptic cleft, and a disruption of that orchestration can yield to neurotoxic effects. In terms of one of the effects, chemicals can damage this myelin sheath on the exterior part of a neuron. There can be various membrane or morphological damages from various neurotoxins and chemically reactive toxicants. There can be necrosis of neurological tissue. An example of necrosis of neurological tissue is in this case study, and this is an equine problem, or a problem that occurs in equine, but it also occurs in some other livestock as well. This is associated with consumption of a toxic plant, problem weed, an invasive weed in many areas of the United States, definitely in the western United States, and this is yellow star thistle. Those of you who have taken a hike, sometimes we'll see in the spring these yellow flowers on a hillside, illustrated in the leftmost photo of this slide. Down in the bottom part, what happens when animals that are pastured where there is a significant amount of yellow star thistle, and if they do start consuming what, at least in my mind, would be marginally palatable if for no other reason of the thorns on yellow star thistle, but there is an intoxication that does occur. The intoxication will lead to a necrosis of tissue. This necrosis in the frontal lobe is referred to as nigropalatial encephalomalacia. I have an arrow drawn in here. These darkened spots in the four lobes of the brain are an indicator of this particular condition. This brain degeneration yields to behavior changes. It is an irreversible condition. One of the prime vectors of neurotoxicity that we are concerned about is cholinesterase inhibition. Cholinesterase inhibition is the mode of action of many of the pesticides, the insecticides, the organophosphorus, and the N-methylcarbamates that we've introduced. In cholinesterase inhibition, we need to understand the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. It's the chemical mediator that's responsible for this physiological transmission of nerve impulses across the synapse. In this cartoon, I'm trying to essentially illustrate that, in fact, our neurological function is by these neurotransmitter chemicals. We think chemistry, if you will. An important part of this transmission is the enzyme acetylcholinesterase. The function of this particular enzyme is to hydrolyze the acetylcholine neurotransmitter. The active site of the acetylcholinesterase, ACHE, actually contains two subsites. And this, these are referred to as the esteratic, it's an ester group, and an anion group. And so these sites are the esteratic and the anionic. Nerve impulses, in terms of normal transmission, will release acetylcholine due to the depolarization. It is rapidly destroyed by acetylcholinesterase, and it allows for a normal, controlled, propagated impulse. When we do have an interference of acetylcholinesterase, this activity leads to an accumulation of the neurohormone acetylcholine, and this essentially allows for a sustained propagation of pulse. It's an excitatory or stimulatory response, and so typically you find in this form of neurotoxicity in the acute stage, perhaps vesiculations, high heart rates, uncontrolled muscular movement, seizuring, those sorts of impacts. I put this figure of acetylcholinesterase up here. This is to give you an idea of that this particular enzyme is a very complex one, but it is best reduced down in terms of looking at the activity of the active site, the receptor site on acetylcholinesterase. We can do this diagrammatically. This shows this whole molecule here, the light blue half moon that I have here. The actual receptor sites, so we have the anionic site here, and we have the esteratic site here with a serine moiety, and we have acetylcholine, and you can see that in normal hydrolysis of acetylcholine by acetylcholinesterase enzyme, you see that in fact we've got this two-point binding at the anionic site and at the ester site here. This binding is very secure and enables the hydrolysis to choline and to acetate. And so this happens in terms of rapid release. And so like normal, in terms of normal enzymatic activity, the enzyme itself here is not consumed by this process. It actually just acts like it should as an enzyme, a normal process. What we find is that we can poison this process by putting compounds in play that are reactive to those same sites in acetylcholine esterase. For example, when I'm down here in the bottom square, I put the organophosphate insecticide parathione. Parathione is a largely limited insecticide. Most uses have been taken off the table in the last decade or so. There might be still some special uses associated with agriculture, but not many. One of the reasons was because of its acute toxicity and neurotoxicity potential. In these OP pesticides, these organophosphorus pesticides, typically, and here's a case for parathione, what you find is that you've got a leaving group here, you can see, for parathione and a phosphate moiety here, which is the active, reactive part that is going to poison acetylcholine esterase. It does it because this phosphate moiety is reactive with the ester group on acetylcholine. As the leaving group leaves, and this is the X part here, you get a phosphorylation of acetylcholine esterase. This phosphorylation is largely irreversible. There is an impact here in terms of limiting the future ability of this enzyme to actually do what it needs to do, and it essentially its reactive sites have been now poisoned. There are antidotes that can impact this, but sometimes these antidotes are either ineffective or especially ineffective if there's been any sort of aging that has occurred in terms of time between the poisoning and time between the administration of the antidote. The way we look at this on a molecular basis, we saw that in fact acetylcholine esterase is a fairly large complex enzyme. There is a place on the molecule, a receptor site, that is referred to as the gorge. Here's the oxyanion hole, and here's the OP binding serine moiety right here. And so this is allowing for the sites of reactivity. We can take a look at that in terms of simplifying those sites of reactivity. Again, the oxyanion hole. We've got, in this particular case, an OP that is binding to that serine moiety, and it's actually blocking. And this gives a two-dimensional representation that allows you at least to do a three-dimensional interpretation of the receptor site here for acetylcholine on acetylcholine esterase. Once we have this OP docking, we've essentially blocked it in terms of its ability to have this reversible deactivation of acetylcholine, the hydrolysis of acetylcholine. Once blocked, the acetylcholine will then just hang out in the synaptic cleft and induce neurotransmission and the excitatory response. One of the ways we can have an antidote to this reactivity is through a chemical called 2-PAM, that's pyridine aldoxime methylchloride. 2-PAM actually can bind to the phosphate moiety that has reacted with choline esterase. It presents a very strong reaction, and it can reverse that binding. It can cleave, in this case, the neurotoxic agent from the enzyme and restore the enzyme's activity. The problem is that typically there will be some residual effects, even though a lethal intoxication might be reversed. There will still be some neurotoxic damage associated with an exposure that requires 2-PAM antidote. 2-PAM is an antidote that is used in terms of defense of perhaps neurotoxins that might be used in chemical warfare. We'll finish up with a quick case study. This is interesting because this is a demonstration of the plant kingdom and some biologically active agents in plants in the human diet and in natural medicinals, one being used as the antidote for the other. This particular case study, also from Mortality Morbidity Weekly, this is a 1994 case where several members and three families were intoxicated after drinking yerba mate tea or Paraguay tea. This is a tea that's available in most health food stores. It's got a little bit of a caffeine type kick to it. It also has some natural components, some phytochemicals, which can cause different levels of effects. And typically also, because sometimes these are harvested from natural environments, toxic plants of various types can be put into the mix in terms of sloppy harvest, if you will. In both of these, in all these cases, the manifestations occurred within about 2 hours of drinking this tea. And this is a commercially processed and produced tea, Paraguay tea, and this particular plant is native to South America. In one of the cases, a 39-year-old man and his 38-year-old wife shared a pot of tea, and within 30 minutes they actually developed acute symptoms, agitation, and flushed skin. They were transported by ambulance to the emergency department. They had fever, dilated non-reactive pupils, dry skin, and oral mucous membranes. Bowel sounds were absent, so there was a definite potential for neurotoxicity there. They were able to be diagnosed as from anticholinergic poisoning based on clinical findings. Anticholinergic poisoning is not cholinesterase inhibition. This is a poisoning where the receptor for acetylcholine is actually blocked. There's a competitive inhibition by a chemical at the receptor site across the synaptic cleft. So there was, in this particular tea, an anticholinergic compound blocking this. The treatment for this individuals were intravenous fezostigmine. What's interesting about this particular chemical, it's a natural product. It's a product from a bean called the calamar bean, which comes from a plant that is referred to as the doomsday plant. This particular plant had a nefarious medicinal history because it used to be used in the examination of prisoners to try to get them uncomfortable, to make them actually talk because of the potential, and in most cases, reversible poisoning associated with this. Fezostigmine is actually a reversible cholinesterase inhibitor. That's actually obtained from a natural plant. So, and the interesting part of this particular case study is we have a toxicant from one plant, a phytochemical coming from one plant, the yerba mate tea, being counteracted by a chemical, a phytochemical from another plant. Well, that gives you, I guess, a sense of the aspects of target organ toxicology that we want you to kind of have in terms of the understanding from your readings and from some of the general broader understandings of environmental toxicology. Next time, what we'll do is talk about perhaps a special category of endpoints, and these endpoints will include carcinogenesis, teratogenesis, and mutagenesis. Until next time, we'll see you later. Thanks so much for being here.